How do you check it?
Good morning, colleagues. I'm happy to call to order this morning this meeting of the Joint Ways and Means Subcommittee on Education for Wednesday, March 29th. Today, we will also reopen the public hearing for Senate Bill 5524, the Higher Education Coordinating Committee budget bill. And we will re-welcome to the stage Ben Cannon, Executive Director, as well as Juan Baez Arevalo, Interim Director, Office of Student Access and Completion.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Ben Cannon, Executive Director of the Higher Education Coordinating Commission. Juan will introduce himself in a few minutes after I present some overview slides. Just to sort of remind the committee where we are, we're starting day three of this presentation, and we'll spend the next day and a half of testimony focused primarily on affordability and the major budget items in the HEX budget related to affordability, including the Oregon Opportunity Grant and the Oregon Promise. But we'll start with a sort of overview of affordability issues and how we as a commission and as an agency think about affordability in higher education. As usual, I encourage you to stop us with questions or comments. I'll note that we have submitted a letter that answers some of the questions that came up during yesterday's testimony. If you have any additional questions or follow-up on that, please do.
And Madam Chair, these letters, like this letter that we just posted this morning, is on yesterday's agenda.
Gotcha. Pat. You generally try to put it on the day that the question was asked.
Okay.
Thank you.
I'll try to remember that.
Always check in with me. I'll tell you.
So at the outset of our presentations 2 days ago, we noted the three major themes of the budget that we're bringing forward. One of them was affordability. So this is a repeat slide that just highlights the emphasis that our budget request places on increasing affordability for Oregonians through fully funding the Oregon Promise and increasing the Oregon Opportunity Grant, which is focused on the state's lowest income students, including working adults. Just to quickly note the specific budget requests, and we'll come back to these in much greater detail after Juan takes the mic, but on the Opportunity Grant, the governor's recommended budget proposes an 8.1% increase over the 2015-17 LAB in order to serve approximately 5,000 additional Oregon students. And again, this is a need-based grant, so it's focused on the highest need students. And for the Oregon Promise, the governor's budget proposes continuing the state's investment for students who are coming directly out of high school and are otherwise eligible for the program. That has an estimated cost of $39.7 million in order to fulfill that promise for the entire biennium. We're in the process of working with staff to revise and update that estimate based on the additional enrollment that we had this year. We'll go into much more depth on this in a few minutes. Key performance measures. So the next section of this presentation will include some of this data, and all of these measures are reported and submitted with the slides that we'll present to you on the last day of our testimony, day 15. But here are some of the key performance measures associated with affordability in our budget. So let me spend the next section, 10 minutes or so, really helping the committee understand how we think about affordability, because it may not be precisely the way the public generally thinks of affordability. And the main point here being that affordability is complex and it's a multidimensional issue. It's about much more than tuition. And so this slide depicts in a sort of simple way the factors that go into true and complete understanding of affordability. And I'll start with the one that we tend to sort of zero in on, and that is tuition. So at 2 o'clock here on this flower chart, you start with where often the conversation starts and ends, which is the question of tuition. And we certainly have, and we'll come back to that as a significant factor that affects affordability. But of course, there are others. And so moving kind of clockwise around this chart, other costs of attendance, which can be significant, and these include room and board, textbooks, supplies, transportation, et cetera. Financial aid, of course, helps address affordability, and financial aid comes in various forms, including state and federal, but also institutional aid and private scholarships and grants that students may receive. And so those are the sort of direct monetary factors that affect affordability. But moving on around the flower, completion and rates of completion and time to completion. A student who takes 5 or 6 years to complete a degree incurs much more costs, as well as opportunity costs from not working or working less, than a student who completes a degree in 4 years. A student who completes a degree has arguably a more affordable experience than one who does not. And that's partly as a result of the earnings that they may or may not be sort of eligible or likely to receive as a result of completion, and that's reflected in that sort of 10 or 11 o'clock on this flower. We've also included here the type of degree or certificate or major that a student obtains, which, again, also impacts their likely earnings. And, of course, the student or family resources contributes significantly to whether or not college is affordable. To get slightly more specific and to start to use some of the terms that you're already familiar with, but we'll come back to again, and I'm not going to go through the definitions here, but we wanted to include them. Tuition and fees, typically mandatory fees, are ones that we would be focused on under this category. Room and board, books and supplies, personal and transportation costs. These, the first four items here, produce what we consider to be the total cost of attendance, and we'll use this figure. It takes sort of estimates of room and board, books and supplies, personal and transportation costs, adds them to tuition and fees. That's the total cost of attendance. Net price, which we're going to show some data on, I think is particularly useful way to start to begin to think more holistically about affordability, because net price deducts from total cost of attendance the likely scholarships and grant aid that a student may receive. So if you're trying to help a family or a policymaker understand the actual costs associated with college, net price, which is total cost of attendance minus grants and scholarships that a student will receive, is a more accurate reflection of their actual costs than tuition and fees alone.
Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Director Cannon, do you the heck have any data on percentage of students that are living in dormitories or in their private homes? You know, we're in a unique position. We're building a university, four-year university in Bend, and one of the early presentations I received, they were looking at 80% living in dormitories, and I don't think that's anywhere close to the reality. Do you have data on that? And have you looked at what's better for us to fund and maintain and build dormitories, or should be private operation completely?
Representative Wisnett, Co-Chair Smith-Warner, members of the committee, we do not have the data systematically on residency, you know, dorm versus private residency by college or university. We could work with the institutions to at least provide some illustrative examples, nor have we studied the particular question of sort of the value of one versus the other.
Follow-up?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. It is, I've looked through some of your slides, that's room and board is the major expense. My recent trip to Chapel Hill, there's more and more high-rise luxury apartments going up for students. And one of my comments I made yesterday about how we're trying to build resorts, which is not, shouldn't be our job. I think it's really something, I haven't read anything or come across anything in all my education stuff I get either, but I think it's something that we really should consider. It is the highest cost factor we're going to see in the next slides coming up, and we need to look at whether it should be, you know, university providing it with state help, or should it, you know, look at more privatization, and then we don't have to worry about ups and downs of recession and how many students, and we don't have to try to build swimming pools and workout rooms to help bring in students.
Representative Lively.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. When you're talking about tuition and fees, I just want to understand. So there are cases fees are agreed to by students to raise versus fees that are I'll say lab fees and other things, and are there not? And is there some, I guess, delineation between those, the fees that the students are involved in the decision to raise it versus those that are not?
Representative Lively, Co-Chair Smith Warner, members of the committee, yes, there are different types of fees, and you've identified several of the key categories. Generally, when we report on tuition and fees, and in the data that you'll, information that you'll see here, we include mandatory fees, which may or may not include the student incidental fee, which is mandatory, but is set by students, not by administrators. When we look at the universities and the HECS role in approving or disapproving proposed tuition increases greater than 5% for resident undergraduate students, we have a formula, a way of calculating that, that excludes the student incidental fee, includes the mandatory university set fees, does not include the lab fees or course specifics fees, since not all students pay those are for materials and supplies associated with certain courses. So you're absolutely right that there are different fees that fall into different categories.
Thank you.
So let's start with tuition, and then we'll broaden the conversation. You've seen this before, the rise in community college tuition over time since 2007-08, an increase of by more than a third. The relatively flat level of the Oregon Opportunity Grant, which we've shown here just for comparison's sake. On the university side, nearly a 50% increase over the same time period in average tuition and fees from just over $6,600 to over $9,000 in the current academic year. This is for a full-time student year-round. These are inflation-adjusted. Again, you see the relatively flat opportunity grant, so not keeping up with that tuition increase. Tuition and fees, how are they set? They're set by the boards, the governing boards of the universities and colleges, respectively. So the public universities, their boards of trustees on an annual basis adopt institutional budgets and tuition levels that support those budgets. Each campus has a community and stakeholder process to inform and shape the proposed increases that are sent to their boards of trustees and adopted by their boards. And then the note here, and I just alluded to the HECS role in approving annual increases in resident undergraduate tuition and mandatory enrollment fees that exceed 5% for those students, resident undergraduate students. And under statute, the HEC or the Oregon legislature must approve the increase. We expect this spring that we will receive those proposals from at least five of Oregon's public universities, and the HEC is working now through a subcommittee and eventually its full commission to consider those proposed tuition increases. We expect to do so at our May full commission meeting. Community colleges, tuition and fees are set by their locally elected governing boards, again, on an annual basis. There is no statutory provision for HEC or legislative oversight in that tuition setting process.
And Mr. Cannon, can you briefly touch on the when or the why of HEC versus the legislature improving the increase?
Co-Chair Smith Warner, this slide nearly quotes the statute and the entirety of the statute. So this is a really essentially the statute says if the university proposes to increase more than 5%, then the HEC or the legislature must approve or must determine whether or not it is appropriate. That's language that's not on the slide, so it uses that word appropriate and approve or disapprove. So this has not really been tested. The HEC on two occasions has dealt with proposed increases greater than 5%. They were largely technical issues having to do with new tuition structures at Eastern Oregon University and Oregon State University, respectively. Certainly the question of what it would mean for the Oregon legislature to give approval has not been tested, and I don't have a firm answer to what it would mean or how the mechanism whereby the Oregon legislature would give approval.
So it has not come up since the 2011 kind of reorg?
Representative Smith Warner, Co-Chair Monroe, members of the committee, it has come up, but well, only on two kind of technical issues, and I believe in 2014 the HEC made those approvals.
Okay.
So as I noted on the sort of at the outset, students face cost challenges, significant ones beyond tuition. And so this is where we start to look at other costs of attendance, mandatory fees, housing, food, transportation, supplies, textbooks, dependent care, the list goes on. And the pie chart here is the result of a survey that we did in 2015 of students, several thousand students around the state that tried to ascertain how much they spent on textbooks. And the results were probably not startling if you're a student or a parent of a student and paying these costs, but maybe startling to others. In a single term, 40% of students reported spending, 50% of students, nearly 50% of students reported spending more than $250 on textbooks. So you start to add that up over the course of the year. We're talking about students who are, many of whom are easily spending $1,000 a year on textbooks over and above, of course, their tuition and fees and food and housing, et cetera. So this is just a single snapshot of the way in which other costs can contribute to the affordability challenge.
Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank Director Cannon for talking about textbooks. The Higher Education Committee passed out a bill yesterday that will be coming to this committee about the open education resource, the free online textbooks. HEC's done a great job managing that last session. They reported $2.1 million savings, from, I think was the number that they reported, that from based estimated savings with these textbooks were out. They're not all out yet in the system. So the bill coming to us, we'll be talking about and hope that this committee will support it.
Thank you.
So to sort of put it all together on total costs, this is a these are the standard estimates of total costs for students attending Oregon public universities, community colleges, and private independent institutions. So this describes the average tuition and fees for a full-time student in each sector, the estimated costs of books and supplies for a year, the estimated room and board costs, and the estimated personal expenses and transportation. There are formulas by which, or methodologies by which, the colleges and universities are determine these, estimate these annual costs, and obviously the actual student budgets will vary widely depending on a variety of factors, but this is a sort of global view of the estimated student costs for attending a single year at a Oregon institution of higher education.
And Ben, I don't know if this was you guys 2 years ago, but we had a great presentation about the difference in how many hours you would have to work at a minimum wage job to pay for even so, like 50% of your college going costs. I don't know if that came from you guys or maybe OSSA.
Representative Smith-Warner, Co-Chair Smith-Warner, we have that information coming up.
Oh, good. Okay. I was going to say, I don't look forward, so I'll be excited to see it.
So moving on, that's the cost side of the equation. This slide attempts to depict some of the ways in which costs are offset for students by federal, state, institutional grants and scholarships. We also note the role that loans play here, although that's substantially different, of course, than a grant or scholarship. And we'll come back to the loan and debt burden. But these are ways in which the overall cost can be driven down for a student or reduced for a student through scholarships, grants, and other forms of aid. The single largest component of that slide is the federal Pell Grant, and so this grant, which is available to qualifying Oregon students based on income, has a maximum in 2015-16 of nearly $5,800. The average Pell Grant awardee in Oregon received $3,400 from the federal government this year. And more than half of all degrees awarded at Oregon public institutions went to students who have received a Pell Grant. So this is a very significant source of funding for higher education in Oregon. Obviously not nearly meeting the total cost, even for our lowest income students. $5,700 doesn't come close to the sort of $17,000 to $40,000 of annual costs that students incur, but a significant contributor to our kind of financial aid picture, and certainly goes a long way to support Oregon students in reducing that cost. in addition to the federal Pell Grant, Oregon, of course, offers its own state aid, the Opportunity Grant, the Oregon Promise. You'll hear about private scholarships that the state, through our Office of Student Access and Completion, that won by Azarevalo leads, administers, and there are other targeted programs, federal and state, that support certain categories of students in higher education, and we'll talk more about these shortly. Just some notes about the importance of grant aid for students. Every thousand, this is according to some national data, but every $1,000 of need-based federal or state grant aid increases graduation rates for low-income students by about 2.5%. On the flip side of the coin, every $1,000 in unsubsidized loans reduces graduation rates by 5.6%. Grant aid is key to making college more affordable, and the reason that matters is that it ensures or helps students to succeed. The relationship between these variables is very, very clear. So I mentioned net price at the outset, and it is essentially cost, total costs minus grant aid. It varies by student, so depending on the amount of costs you have and the amount of grant aid you receive, it will vary. But we can look at averages, and that's what we'll do on the upcoming slides, and we'll get to Coach Smith Warner's question about sort of how much work is required, how many weeks of work at minimum wage are required to afford college. And again, I want to just emphasize that this notion of net price, looking at average costs minus average aid, is a much more useful way of thinking about whether college is affordable or how affordable college is than looking at tuition alone or even looking at total costs alone, because it factors in the institutional and federal and state aid that a student receives. So when we do that, I'm going to sort of stop and dwell on the next two slides for a moment. So this now gives you the net price, the average net price at community colleges for students at different income levels. So we know students at the lower income levels receive more in the way of grant and scholarship aid, and so their net price is lower. But of course, their income is lower too. So this slide sort of packages all of that, and it expresses that for, let's just look at the middle income case, the $48,000 to $75,000 income range. For a student in that income range or whose family is in that income range, their average net price, meaning after they've factored in their scholarships and grant aid, would be $10,500 for a year of community college. Now, that would represent 17% of their income. And at the bottom of the slide, we note that students would have to work an average of 17 hours a week at Oregon minimum wage to pay for net price to attend a public two-year institution full-time. So that's across all of these income ranges. That's sort of what it works out to. But you see that at the lowest income range, where many of our community college students, especially returning adult community college students, are as job seekers or underemployed or minimally employed, 47% of their annual income would be required to afford $8,000 per year net price. That's after taking into account grant and scholarship aid that they receive. So this helps to illustrate, I think, more effectively than just looking at tuition costs or even looking at total costs, the affordability challenge that Oregon students face at different income levels.
Can I ask two quick questions about that slide?
Yes.
Number one, are those quintiles based on Oregon, kind of the quintiles of Oregon taxpayers? Or how did you divide that up? Sorry, I'm on revenue, and so we see quintiles all the time. Based on the tax returns.
Warner, I don't think these are quintiles. I think these are simply arbitrary cut points in income ranges, and it comes from a national survey, and I think they used the same income ranges for every state and just created sort of a comparable.
Okay. And then to confirm before, and I know Senator Roblin has a question, so that is the net price for 1 year or for a complete two-year degree?
Representative Smith Warner, members of the committee, this is for a single year at an Oregon Community College full-time.
Thank you. Senator Roblin?
And that net price includes housing and food and all the other accounts, right? So the 47% would mean that they've taken care of housing, they've taken care of food, they've taken care of all of those kinds of things. It's just they still got $100,000, which included all those things.
Senator Roblin, Representative Smith Warner, yes, important point. So net price, does include their estimated costs of housing, food, textbooks, transportation, et cetera. It discounts them the aid that they've received
right.
to support that, and it leaves them with an $8,000 bill. Moving on, the same slide for our public universities. And as I look at my notes, Co-Chair Smith Warner, I can confirm these are not quintiles, although it's a roughly equal breakout, it looks like, sort of accidentally, these are roughly similar sized groups,
okay.
At least in terms of Oregon's overall population. But now looking at the university side, where you see you look at that, again, $48,000 to $75,000 income bracket, where 26% of a family's income would be required in order to support a student, the student's full costs after scholarship and grant aid to attend an Oregon public university. That's the $16,000, and that would represent 27 hours a week. 27 hours a week, year-round work at Oregon minimum wage. So, again, just a sort of more nuanced way of thinking about affordability.
Representative Lively.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. So if I understand this, the minimum wage, 27 hours a week, still means the percentage over here, that there's still, even if they're working that, to pay that, it's that percentage at that rate. Is still takes that percentage of their wages. So if I go back to the 12,500, that's 72%. So even if they work 27 hours a week, 7 days or the weeks out of the year, it's still that's 72% of whatever they've earned in those 27 hours.
Representative Lively, co-chairs, I think we may be trying to do a little too much in this slide, but So the 12,500, so if we take the top row of this, that's the cost that the student or their family would bear. And that could be earned through 27 hours a week of work on the part of the student. Alternatively, that family income at 30,000, so let's think of a sort of traditional student who is supported in part by their family. So an 18-year-old, 19-year-old student, their family income of 0 to 30,000, if we look at the average family in that range, they'd have to contribute 72% of their income to. So it's sort of either or.
Sure. Thank you.
Is how to think about this.
Senator Roblin.
So do we know what the average cost for housing and food alone for those poorest groups takes of as a percentage of their income? I know I've seen it in the statistic in other places because those are the most expensive parts of people who live in poverty.
Senator Roblin, co-chairs, so back on slide, at least in my packet, it's slide 78, we have the estimates for room and board, books and supplies, personal expenses and transportation by sector. Those estimates would not vary officially by income level, so you can use that's how these slides are or estimates are built, is by assuming certain levels of cost associated for all students with room and board, books and supplies, personal expenses and transportation. Obviously families and students have ways of managing that. Living at home would be one, for example, for some students, one way of significantly reducing their room and board costs.
I'm just thinking that not regarding education at all, so there's taking that out of the picture completely, just looking at our poorest citizens who make that, 0 to 30,000, what do they currently pay without going to college? Just what portion of their income goes to food and housing? Because I would bet that it's close to that same number, because they disproportionately pay more of their salary for rent and other kinds of stuff anyway. So that was just for me. I'll think about that one.
Yeah. While we're on the topic of sort of these affordability challenges beyond tuition, just a couple of data points on food insecurity. We have on the left-hand side the sadly familiar statistic about the rate of food insecurity in Oregon generally. And then in the right-hand side, the college-specific or higher education-specific data on food insecurity, where 48% reported of students reported food insecurity in one survey. And then in a separate one, about half of community colleges students were housing insecure, 13 to 14% are homeless. I know it's not a surprise to this committee, but important, I think, to note the issues of housing and food insecurity that affect Oregonians generally also affect, very much so, our students in higher education. So we've talked about the total costs, including housing, books, food, transportation, talked about scholarships and grants. But in my original flower sort of chart that described the dimensions of affordability, I also noted that completion really does matter because it relates to your likelihood of having earnings that can help support and repay the borrowing that a student may have done as in order to attend college. These are a couple of rates that we'll come back to when we look at our colleges and universities in more detail. There's significant problems with the methodology behind the community college rate, which is depicted here as 17.3% completion of an associate's within 3 years. Representative Parrish, I think on the first day, noted the challenge or the fact that there are students who leave colleges before completing a certificate or degree because they got a great job, and right, that would be considered sort of a non-completion here, but is nevertheless probably a success for the students. So understanding that there are caveats on both of these figures, this is the sort of standardly reported graduation rate in our respective sectors, and certainly does indicate that there's opportunity to improve and work to do that can help to address affordability, even as it has many other benefits as well. Likewise,
can I ask a quick question about that? Just a quick methodology question. Is there a reason you chose to do it like with the same ending year for both cohorts rather than the same starting year? Maybe it was just the data available. I just noticed that.
Co-Chair Smith-Warner, I'm not sure about that. Typically, these do get expressed in terms of their cohort year, and we'll follow up with you about
thank you.
What we were including here. Likewise, time to degree, and I mentioned this earlier, but here's a little bit of data on it. The average community college student takes 4 years to complete an associate's degree. That's often because they're going part-time or coming in and out. They're working at the same time. That contributes to cost. The average Oregon Public University student who has transferred from an Oregon community college, so this is your transfer student, it takes that student an additional 3 years on average to complete a bachelor's degree. That contributes to cost. That additional time contributes to cost. The average Oregon Public University student who starts at a public university, comes directly from a high school and goes directly into a public university, it takes an average of 4.5 years. Again, that's additional cost, partly in tuition, but primarily in terms of living costs and opportunity costs for not working with a degree. The right-hand bar here notes the lifetime limits on some forms of financial aid, including the Pell Grant, and students who are taking more credits than are strictly necessary, for example, to earn a degree, may run up against these limits, and that too exacerbates the affordability challenges.
Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair and Director Cannon. How do we compare to other states, and how do we compare with private universities? Do you have that data?
Representative Wisnett, Co-Chair Smith-Warner, Co-Chair Monroe, I do not have that data. We may have a way of getting at it, and I think it's a great question. I don't know.
Representative Lively, did you have another one?
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. So the assumption I make in this, it has nothing to do with availability of courses. It has to do with timing, so whether they have to work or other things that stretches out that time, and specifically those that transfer from a two-year to where it takes three more years. I'm just trying to understand the difference, I guess.
Representative Lively, co-chairs, it's a great question, and I sort of take the easy way out. There are a lot of factors that contribute to greater than expected times of completion, including including affordability, the fact that students are working and going part-time, many of them, but also, at least in some cases, course availability, issues of course of credit transfer, and whether credits that are earned at a community college, for example, apply towards a degree or a major at a university. Starting tomorrow, in the second part of the morning, we will spend a couple of days really focused on that question of student pathways, which is so central to the HECS work as a coordinating commission. And you'll hear about some of the efforts to address this through that
Thank
work.
You.
All of this data that we've presented around affordability goes to show the need that the majority of Oregon public post-secondary students have to borrow, because they simply cannot make ends meet, given the rising costs, given the increasing time to degree, given the insufficiency of grant and scholarship aid. And as a result, we have significant borrowing in Oregon, as in other parts of the country. Among Oregon Community College FAFSA filers in 2015-16, 75% had unmet need after their expected family contribution, which is itself maybe the family may be unable to meet. But even after all of that is factored in, there's 75% of students have unmet need, and on the university side, 83%. That drives borrowing. 63% of Oregon's four-year graduates take out loans. That compares actually favorably, slightly, with the national average of 68%. The median loan amount for Oregon four-year graduates is $27,697, slightly less than the $30,000 national average. So borrowing is significant, borrowing slightly less in Oregon than the national average, but it is certainly a major feature of how community college and four-year university students finance their educations.
Co-chair.
Mr. Co-chair.
That's kind of a striking statistic given the low level of support in Oregon for higher education. The fact that even with the low level of support compared to other states, our students don't have to borrow quite as much or don't choose to borrow quite as much. I wouldn't have predicted that given what I know about how much support we give our students and what our tuition levels are and so on.
Senator Memoro, Co-Chair Smith-Warner, neither would I, given that our tuitions are slightly higher than the national average, our state appropriations are slightly lower, our grant aid is lower than the national average. That would suggest higher borrowing rates than average, and I think it bears further investigation.
Representative Wiseman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I feel I have to go back to slide 86 and put on the public record that as a state legislator elected by the people, I am just astonished at 16.1% of Oregonians have food insecurity and that our college students are 48%. I think that's a terrible reflection upon the leadership in this building and in the governorship, including myself, that we have those statistics in a state so blessed as Oregon, from pears to fish to whatever, that we don't address feeding our people first. We worry about a lot of things, but I was on the State Commission for Children and Families, and we were listed as one of the worst hunger situations in the nation. As legislators, we should focus more on that. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm sorry.
Thank you.
And Madam Co-Chair.
Mr. Co-Chair.
And with that fact, and of course, this committee over the last 10 years has worked very hard to pass school nutrition programs and so on. Now we read that the current national administration is wanting to cut all of those programs drastically.
Go ahead.
So just to wrap up this kind of affordability overview before we look at specific Oregon programs that Juan will describe, it's a multidimensional problem. It takes multidimensional solutions. And so this is just a summary slide. Starting at the top, we should minimize the need for tuition increases, in part through state investment. We should increase grant aid for the lowest income students, especially. We should create lower cost pathways to lower division and career and technical education programs. We need to smooth transfer pathways to four-year institutions in order to improve time to degree and success rates. Improving success rates themselves, that will improve affordability because more students graduating means fewer students leaving with debt and without a degree or certificate. Reducing barriers to fields and careers associated with higher earnings will have a positive impact on affordability. And finally, supporting innovations that reduce the cost side of the equation. And Representative Wisnant mentioned the work that the policy committee has done in conjunction with the HEC on OERs, and that's one example of the type of innovation that can help bring down the cost in the first place. With that, I'm going to turn it over to our interim director of the HEC Office of Student Access and Completion, Juan Baez-Arevalo. Let me say by way of introduction, Juan's been with the HEC for a few years, has been running the Office of Private Postsecondary, but last fall stepped into an interim role at OSAC and has managed that well. He comes to us from, came to the HEC from K-12, where he was a school principal and a district administrator, and has had a variety of roles before that. So really glad to have Juan now leading our work down in Eugene at OSAC, and he'll walk us through some of the key OSAC programs.
Good morning, Co-Chair Monroe, Co-Chair Smith-Warner, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Juan Baez-Arevalo. I serve as HEC's Interim Director of the Office of Student Access and Completion. It is my privilege this morning to share with you the impact of Oregon's public financial aid programs and how these critical investments fit in the governor's recommended budget. I'll begin with the Oregon Opportunity Grant. The Oregon Opportunity Grant is Oregon's only state-funded need-sensitive grant program that helps low-income Oregonians, including young people and adults. Starting in 2016-17, the OOG is awarded first to students with the greatest financial need and their expected family contribution as the basis. The maximum award amount for 2016-17 is $2,250 towards their expenses. And the awards can be prorated for part-time or part-year enrollment. The goal of the Opportunity Grant is to increase college enrollment, completion, and affordability for Oregon students who have demonstrated financial need. For the current biennium, the estimated total number of students served by the Oregon Opportunity Grant is 81,181, with an estimated distribution of total funds to students at $137 million. General funds, as you can see, account for most of the funding for the Oregon Opportunity Grant, and lottery funds account for a small but significant and unfortunately an unpredictable amount of dollars. It is worth noting that lottery funds did not come through at the budgeted level, so we had to go back to the legislature and request an additional $3.1 million in new funds to meet the commitment to students for the current academic year. This chart provides you with a representation of the Oregon Opportunity Grant distributions over time. As you can see, what would otherwise represent a slight growth curve over the years instead experienced a peak and a subsequent dramatic drop as Oregon and the nation felt the impact of the recession. The Oregon Opportunity Grant is a successful program. However, it does not meet demand. The impact of the increased investment the Oregon legislature made in 2015-17 is that more applicants will receive the grant, but many eligible applicants will not. The improvement in 2016-17 reflects the increased funds and a change in the number of eligible students, as the program is now focused on the lowest income students and only those students with expected family contributions at or below $4,000 received awards in 2016-17. This chart represents the significant funding gap that continues to exist. As you can see, fall 2016 recipients accounted for less than half of all eligible applicants. And with nearly 46,000 OOG eligible applicants not awarded, it is clear that there is much need for support that this grant can provide to students.
Can I ask a quick question about this? Does that The spike and the dip, is that what we talk a lot about during the depths of the recession? So that really, I mean, to me, that's the most vividly I've seen it demonstrated, that you've gone from almost 160,000 folks looking for this to only 88,000. That's, you know, enormous.
Madam Co-Chair, correct. That what you see there is that representation of the growth of enrollment that occurred in the middle of the recession. Mm-hmm. As was discussed previously, many working adults had to go back to school to get training, and obviously the gap grew considerably during that time period. Also a time period when there were less resources available to meet the demand.
Yes.
Madam Chair, members, you need to note, though, that during the 09-11 biennium, there was sort of quite a bit given out in the first year of the biennium, running out of money, and then the second. And I believe some of the public institutions made up some of the difference in the second year of the biennium.
Correct. So when it comes to funding student aid, Oregon has room to grow. Our state ranks in the bottom third nationally for need-based grant dollars on both on a per capita basis and per 18 to 24-year-olds in the state. On a positive note, the majority of the need-based grant dollars goes to students at public institutions, furthering state investments in public colleges and universities to foster equity and student success. As indicated, the majority of recipients and disbursements do go to students at public institutions, and in 2015-16, as you can see, the program disbursed $26.5 million to 18,528 students at Oregon Community Colleges, $32 million were disbursed to 18,091 students at Oregon Public Universities, and a smaller $5 million were disbursed to 2,645 students at Oregon private nonprofit colleges and universities. Now, House Bill 2407 of the 2015 legislative session brought about the redesign of the Oregon Opportunity Grant award process to ensure that the highest need students receive the financial support they need. The key changes included prioritizing awards based on need, not based on when students applied, and awarding grants for the second year to those students who continue to meet eligibility criteria. And as mentioned earlier, starting with 2016-17, primarily students with EFCs of $4,000 or less received awards. The second year guarantee will first be implemented in the 2017-18 school year. Now, as you can see, the effect of the restructure of the OOG as a result of House Bill 2407 is clear. Students with a lower expected family contribution, lower income students with EFCs of $4,000 or less, are projected to receive 99.8% of the funding of the $71 million that's being spent this year, including all of $7 million year-over-year increase in the funding for the program. It is clear that for 2016-17, the largest group of recipients is those with an EFC of zero. They experienced the most significant increase in disbursements because of the restructure.
Let me, if I can interject here, we've used the term expected family contribution. I think the committee is clear, but let me just underscore that expected family contribution is computed based on a student or their family's completion of the FAFSA, and it takes into account income and certain assets, number of dependents in college, to compute what a family can be estimated to contribute to college. So lower EFC means generally lower income, lower asset, lower ability to contribute to college. This slide shows the distributional effects of shifting the Oregon Opportunity Grant to focus on the lowest EFC, lowest income students, as you did through passing 2407 in 2015. And since I know the committee and the legislature is quite interested in this question on state financial aid, of the kind of what income families are getting it and how is that changing, particularly in the context of the Oregon Promise, which we'll talk about shortly. I think it's important to note that the shift that has been made to the Oregon Opportunity Grant means that significantly more dollars are going to lower income, lower EFC families through the Opportunity Grant than were before. So if you look just at the right-hand part of the bar graph here, before 2016-17, we spent $7 million on families with EFCs of greater than 4,000. These are somewhat more affluent. To be clear, 4,000 EFC is not an affluent family. But this starts to move into the middle income range that the Oregon Opportunity Grant was originally intended to serve. Because we can't meet all of the need, the middle income need, we focused the grant. The legislature directed us to focus the grant on the lowest income students. That has produced a significant boost for our $0 EFC students, and it has withdrawn the award effectively from some middle income families who used to qualify for it. We simply do not have enough money to serve middle income and low income families. We've focused the grant on the lowest income families and their students.
Thank you.
Let's transition to the Oregon Promise. So a little bit of history. Senate Bill 81 of the 2015 legislative session created the Oregon Promise program to provide a waiver of tuition for community college courses. The program provides tuition costs for up to 90 credits. It is a last dollar program. And the minimum grant for a full-time student is $1,000 per academic year to a maximum of $3,397 for 2016-17. The Oregon Promise is designed to increase college enrollment, completion, and affordability for recent high school graduates and GED recipients. So who is eligible for the Oregon Promise Grant? The student must be a recent high school graduate or GED recipient, have a 2.5 cumulative GPA or higher, must not have more than 90 college credits completed or attempted, and the student must be an Oregon resident at least 12 months prior to enrollment. And of critical importance, the student must plan to attend an Oregon Community College within 6 months of graduation.
And that 90 credits, that includes advanced placement and credits are earned during high school? Or does it not?
Madam Co-Chair, it does include credits earned during high school, and many students do attempt to gain college credit during high school.
Thank you. Yeah, Representative Wisnick.
Thank you. And Higher Education Committee, we're working on some people we overlooked as far as a six-month graduation. There's some legislation coming to take care of, you know, people that get sick, people that military, and things like that. So there are some. We're going to look at in who we need to give waivers to as far as the 6 months graduation.
The application funnel that you see here provides you with a visual representation of the volume of qualifying high school graduates in 2016 down to the actual number that received the award during the fall. With 19,223 applicants, you can imagine the volume of work that OSAC staff processed as they reviewed and verified applications prior to making the awards for fall term. A considerable amount of work and processing for our staff.
That's a huge drop off for not meeting the basic eligibility requirements from 19,000 to 10,000 when they are relatively low in the most, you know, respectful way possible.
Coach Smith Warner, I would just note on that. I tried to submit an app just for the fun of it to see if the system was working. So my application may be included in that 19,223. Clearly I am not eligible, right, and was screened out at that initial filter. But we got a lot of interest from folks who may not have known that you have to be a high school student or a recent,
right,
you know, GED graduate.
Gotcha. Yeah. Representative Lively.
Co-chair, so just so I understand, so the 1,091 enrolled in public universities were people who had applied in that but ended up going to the university and community college.
Representative Lively, Madam Co-chair, Ms. Co-chair, correct. That is correct. That is the students who went on to a public university.
Senator Roblin.
And the other thing about the 19,000, they had to complete a FAFSA. Some didn't want to do that. Others, weren't ever considered going to a community college, but they did need to do their FAFSA, so because they wanted to get that money. So, I mean, there's a lot of people who, and I commend the OSAC on making a process that basically signed you up for this if you did a FAFSA. I mean, when you went into the FAFSA, you were going to get all the information on that screen to tell you you've completed or not completed this application. And I had a lot of kids comment on how nice that was. Yeah. And some of them said, I didn't really want to promise. I was going to university. But it was nice to know, because it would say you're 95% or 90% or whatever complete with the grant. And they said, oh, it was kind of, and a number of them that didn't actually go do it, because you go from 10 to 6, said, I get used to completing, so I just figured, what, I might as well do the next part, and completed the application, even though I knew I was going to a four-year school. So, but the process, you made it very convenient for kids in the process, and I really appreciate that, because I think that was part of the hope that would happen, and I was pleased to hear from a lot of kids that it was pretty simple. When the FAFSA is the hardest thing for them to get their parents and everybody to agree to. Once they've done that, this process made it really easy to do this. So thanks for the work.
And the last thing, there's about 50 to 60,000 kids that graduate from high school every year here. Is that right, or am I way too high?
Coach Smith-Warner, members of the committee, it's closer to between 30 and 35,000 graduates.
That's a pretty significant chunk then.
Yeah.
It applied. That's great.
Now, 50,000 babies born every year.
Yeah, that's the one.
I knew I was thinking of. That came from somewhere.
Now, in its first year, the Oregon Promise has demonstrated a positive impact on the enrollment of high school graduates who go on and enroll at a community college. That's very clear.
I'll just sort of add to that. This is the closest we've come to trying to estimate the actual impact of the program, which is difficult to do because various things are changing, and understanding what the impact of this specific program has been is difficult. But when we looked at fall 2014 data and tried to discern, and it's, again, this is a data challenge in the absence yet of a longitudinal data system, but when we've tried to discern how many of those fall 2014 community college students, new community college students, were recent graduates of an Oregon public high school, we found about 5,700. When we look ahead, that was before the promise, look ahead to the most recent fall term, we found 6,500. That's the 844 increase that's called out here, and that almost certainly underestimates, because that fall 2014 number, the 5,700, that's everyone who took six or more credits and was a recent graduate, including those who would not have qualified for the Oregon Promise because they had less than a 2.5 GPA. The fall 2016 numbers, that's just Oregon Promise students. They had 2.5 GPA, the recent high school graduates. They had six or more credits. So that's a fairly sizable increase, and we think it actually underestimates the total increase. You may wonder about fall 2015, which was the last fall before the Promise, and we simply didn't have the data for that fall. At the time we did this analysis, we had to look back to fall 2014.
And it's worth mentioning that the Oregon Promise is a last dollar program that builds upon other federal and state aid. So here you have three different examples. Student A, who has a lower expected family contribution, qualifies for a large Pell Grant, qualifies for the Oregon Opportunity Grant, and receives a small last dollar Oregon Promise grant. Now, student B has a higher expected family contribution, therefore a small Pell Grant and a larger last dollar Oregon Promise grant. And lastly, student C here has the highest expected family contribution, doesn't qualify for Pell or the Oregon Opportunity Grant, and subsequently the Oregon Promise is the sole and last dollar source of funding for that student.
And to be clear, student A, even if all of their cost for 12 credits was covered by the Pell Grant, the Opportunity Grant, they would still get $1,000.
Correct.
Thank you.
The distribution of Oregon Promise recipients by Pell award amount confirms that the majority of recipients, or 53%, have a higher family incomes and does receive no Pell award. As previously indicated, the example of student C, the amount of Oregon Promise Award is larger for these students. And since there is no federal Pell Award or Oregon State Grant, Oregon Opportunity Grant to help cover the tuition expenses. Now, when one reviews the projected awards by EFC quintiles, it is evident that the largest proportion of the total Oregon Promise state funding, almost 60%, goes to students in the fourth and the fifth quintiles. That is to students with much higher expected family contributions.
I'm going to show him the slides.
Oh, there's my quintiles. Good. Representative Lively.
I'm sorry, thank you.
I learned a word today.
So this, the range, if you go back to the, okay, on that slide.
No.
So that range, I'm trying to understand that. So the expected family contribution. So you're telling me in this fifth listing, 19,840 above, is that annual expected contribution to the cost?
Correct. That is Representative Lively. I'm co-chair, Mr. Co-chair, it is correct. That is the annual expected contribution the family can make towards the education expenses.
And it goes back to all of those factors. And
Representative Lively, co-chairs, yes. It would be, I think, more familiar to us to think about this in terms of income versus expected family contribution.
Right.
But I think expected family contribution is actually a more useful or appropriate measure because it does take into account number of dependents in college, assets, et cetera. But generally speaking, you can correlate the EFC ranges or EFC, expected family contribution, to income. And so a student with a $20,000 expected family contribution, so that's sort of fifth quintile here, the most affluent students, this would be at the $20,000 EFC range, that's a family with an average AGI, adjusted gross income, of around $100,000. So just to give you a set, again, there's going to be a lot of variation
sure.
in there. You'll have families with lower AGIs mm-hmm. that end up with high EFCs because of other forms of assets or wealth, maybe fewer dependents, et cetera. But on average, that's in the start. That last quintile starts at about $100,000 AGI.
Senator Roblin?
What we are also seeing is that percentage, that's the percentage of money because the ones at the top are more. But by doing it in quartiles, we know that the first quartile, second quartile is two-fifths of the total number of kids that were applied. The third quartile, if you go to that high, you're talking about three-fifths of all people. And only one-fifth of the people mm-hmm. who actually got one were in those other ones. So the distribution is by amount, not by the number of students that are getting it. So in this quartile, all the equal quartiles are the same number of people, right?
Correct. Senator Roblin, co-chairs, that is correct. Each quintile here contains 20% of the total number of student recipients.
Yeah. Right.
The dollars are stacked significantly towards the upper quintiles because of the structure of the program as a last dollar program.
Now, this table provides us with a representation of the diversity of the students who are participating in the Oregon Promise. As you can see, it is almost the distribution is almost as diverse as the high school graduates for 2015-16. It is clear that we have some outreach work to do to both increase and I would say also maintain the participation of various subgroups. And I believe in the past a similar chart was presented that had high school seniors, and the percentage of high school seniors remarkably was different than those that were recipients. This is the high school graduates. So if you remember that chart, there's a difference between the seniors and then those who actually graduate at the end of the year. Now, Oregon Promise recipients are throughout the state. As you can see, Portland Community College and Chemeketa Community College do have the largest number of Oregon Promise grant recipients in the state. But we have Oregon Promise recipients in every single community college.
So could I request, well, first of all, I, of course, just had to count and who is missing. There's only 16 there. So who's missing?
Co-Chair Smith Warner, Senator Monroe, Oregon Coast Community College has its small number of Oregon Promise recipients included in the Portland Community College figures because of their relationship with the community college and financial aid
and
that's
if,
overseen by PCC.
If this had been a couple of years ago, that they would have been
right.
in CLAPSIPS.
Gotcha.
So who was working with them to
okay.
get their accreditation? And they're hoping to get that soon. But it Portland has been very helpful with all of the small schools. They have been kind of the agent in a number of these situations, including CLAPSIP before them. So,
right. And then could because I know you guys are good at this stuff, could you get us this represented to give us a sense of how that matches up with the relative student populations of those community colleges? Like, of course, it's the highest for PCC, but is PCC overrepresented based on their, or are they underrepresented? Sorry, you don't have to do it by tomorrow.
Representative Smith Warner, co-chairs, we're smiling because we actually had that slide in the presentation. We took it out.
Okay. You can just send it to me.
So
that's fine.
We will happily send it to you. It is.
It's hard to read, probably.
And it begs some additional
yes.
questions because the rates are considerably different, and in part, I think that represents the fact that our colleges have different missions and emphases, some
Very
that
much
are
so.
Much more focused on enrolling direct from high school students mm-hmm. and as a result see a much greater percentage of their total FTE
yes.
in their Oregon Promise populations, others with less. But we'd be happy to provide mm-hmm. it.
Thank you.
Now, the Education Northwest conducted a review of the Oregon Promise and issued a report according to the Education Northwest report, the availability of the Oregon Promise grant is influencing students' post-secondary decision-making. In fact, nearly a third of first-generation respondents who received the grant reported that without the Oregon Promise, they would not have gone to college. That is very significant. Now, 75% of first-generation students who were familiar with the Oregon Promise agreed through that survey that the program made them see that college could be affordable and made them think about going to college. So the changing of that mindset is very, very significant as a result. Now, an estimated 44% of fall 2016 Oregon Promise recipients were first-generation college-going students. Here you have some student voices that were quoted there in the study by Education Northwest, and I'd like to invite all of you to read silently the student comments captured in that report. Perhaps you've heard similar student voices in your local communities. So researchers, of course, will have the big question, so that the Oregon Promise changed the Oregon high school graduate enrollment in higher education. And as discussed, the preliminary results do suggest that while community college enrollment rates might be declining or have declined, there is an increase due to the recent high school graduates going on to community colleges because of the Oregon Promise.
Mr. Manager.
Representative Wisnant.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. We started this program in Higher Education Committee I was in, and we were following the Tennessee model. I understand Tennessee is still not up to us yet. Are we the only state that's doing this, and how are other states coming along, or what are we seeing across the map on this?
Representative Wisnant, co-chairs Monroe and Smith Warner. Oregon is 1 year behind Tennessee in the implementation of the program, so they're in the current academic year represents their second year of a statewide promise program that has a similar structure to Oregon's. They'll start their third year next fall. There is legislation in over a dozen states currently. Minnesota has a, I think, something close to a pilot program, And then at a local and sort of regional level, there are promise-like programs all over the country, the most famous and longstanding of which is actually in Michigan, the Kalamazoo Promise, which is not a state-funded promise but a philanthropic promise to students in the Kalamazoo region to attend tuition-free community college, has existed for, you know, a dozen years or so and is well-studied.
Senator Roblin.
We have a philanthropic one here for two of our high schools. They've had to change the rules a little bit because they had people moving in at both Philomath and over in Eastern Oregon at our boarding school. That's been in place for, I don't know, 50 to 100 years or more. I mean, where kids that go to those, graduate from those schools, have the opportunity to have grants to go to community or any Oregon institution. So,
cool. Representative, are you finished?
Thank you, Madam Chair. One of the things that Tennessee started, I understand, is not going through, and we've spent some money on, is the mentoring program. That was a key part of the thing that we're looking at to be sure they succeeded. Are you going to talk about the mentoring program, the money that was spent on that, and how that's going?
Representative Wisna, Co-Chair Smith-Warner, I believe that during our community college presentation, we will describe the investment that the 2015 legislature made in additional advising resources as well as first-year experience courses for Oregon Promise students, which at least anecdotally have contributed to the success that we've seen so far in the Oregon Promise. On the question of mentors, we should note that one of the differences between the Tennessee program and the Oregon program is that the Tennessee program requires community mentors, and there's a significant energy and activity behind recruiting, developing, and training community mentors for all Tennessee Promise recipients, and that's not a feature of the Oregon Promise program.
Thank you for those comments.
Thank you. So I think might we be at a pausing point since it's almost quarter two. The other thing I would just, the Oregon Promise is indeed something that we all hear about a lot, and I think it's very important as we look at this year is trying to balance our desire to have this, you know, this promise, this opportunity, with try to maximize its impact while under constrained financial situations, and figuring out how do we deal with the fact that indeed most of the dollars are going to recipients with higher incomes, without overlooking the fact that indeed the point is indeed we're trying to get middle income families, but how indeed do we define that when we are continuing to significantly underfund the Oregon Opportunity Grant for folks who we know are lower income and who can get in and use that through other, not just straight out of high school ways. So that to me is one of the big thing, kind of the big things that we need to wrestle with on the higher ed level here. That was my chair's privilege comment. Any other questions? Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
We will see you both tomorrow. I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 5524. And unless there's anything else for the good of the order, I will close the hearing and see you all tomorrow. Thank you. I will close the hearing and see you all tomorrow.